For over a century, the medium of radio has created a unique intimacy between broadcasters and their audience like no other art form. Echoing and celebrating the changing face of popular culture, radio stars occupy a certain space in the story of entertainment. In this series, some of Britain's most recognisable voices reflect on their own relationship with the original content creator. So, join us as we celebrate the power and magic of radio exclusively on Beyond the Title.
One of the most recognisable voices in radio, presenter and broadcaster Jo Wiley got her first taste of entertainment when she secured a music booker role on Channel 4's seminal youth magazine series The Word, alongside Terry Christian and a young Zoe Ball. A revolution at BBC Radio 1 in 1993 signalled the beginning of a new era for British music, and Jo was selected to partner the fellow DJ Steve Mack for the groundbreaking evening session, which heralded a revolution in music which would make up the new sound of Radio 1. This was followed by a promotion to the weekday lunchtime slot, where Jo would spend the next 12 years, where she spearheaded the creation and development of Radio 1's Live Lounge until 2009, when she moved to the relaxed pace of weekend afternoons. Yet in 2011, she left Radio 1 and found her new home on Radio 2, where she is the perfect companion for weekday evenings and has fronted the hugely successful Radio 2 in concert. I caught up with the undisputed queen of live events to talk music, fashions and her recollections on an unprecedented career in British broadcasting. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Jo Wiley. Firstly, welcome to Beyond the Title. Throughout your career, you've celebrated and championed some of the biggest and influential names in popular culture. But do you like talking about yourself?
I would way rather be listening to other people than talking about myself. I much more enjoy having a conversation, finding out what makes people tick and getting to understand them. I find it really hard talking about myself. I want to be the one that's asking the questions, not doing all the answering. I'm shy. It just does not come naturally at all.
We trawled through the archives to try and find your first BBC radio credit. And am I right in thinking that it was for a Radio 4 programme entitled WPFM?
Yeah, good knowledge.
What can you tell us about that show?
Oh, WPFM was fantastic. It was the best training I could ever have had as a journalist. So I went to university and I did languages, didn't do very well, went and did a journalism course. And when that all finished, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So during the course of the journalism, I'm having to cast my mind back because this is quite a long time ago. Where I did some work experience. That's it. I did some work experience when I was doing my postgrad diploma, and I got in touch with someone at Radio 4, and there was this unit called Schools Radio, and they were putting out a program called Wavelength at the time. Then it became WPFM, and it was presented by Terry Christian, who then went on to work on The Word, and Gary Crowley, a really great DJ. And I was a researcher, so they just gave me some work experience working on that. And then when I finished my diploma, I carried on working with them. So that was my entry into radio and Radio 4. And then Gary and Terry both left and I became the presenter. And it was fantastic because it covered everything. So it was all to do with music, and it was the arts, and it was social issues and education. So it was a very, very complicated show and a really good grounding for working in radio. There was a lot to it. Hmm.
You mentioned The Word there. You secured the role of a music booker on the show The Word. How crucial was that in establishing links to the bands which you would go on to champion throughout your early days at Radio 1? And in what ways did this enhance your credibility when inviting artists to appear on the evening session?
I think I was already working in the music industry, so I'd got a reputation already, and that's why I was invited onto, Radio 1, because of the Nirvana moment and also booking bands, whether it was Rage Against the Machine or L7 or any of those bands. And it was a guy called Jeff Smith who used to run the evening session, so he knew that I had a passion for radio, passion for music. So that's absolutely was my entry point into Radio 1. That's why that happened. Really, The Word was a gift. I was employed there because they knew that I loved music and I was going to gigs all the time and I knew lots of people in the industry. And that's why they just gave me a free rein on The Word. I was very, very lucky. It's a guy called Charlie Parsons, who is a brilliant TV exec. And he just employed me just on a whim and trusted me to do whatever I wanted. So I was very lucky to get a break on The Word and then to get a break on Radio 1.
How do you think The Word set the benchmark for pop music shows of the 90s?
Oh, it was the one, wasn't it? It was the ultimate youth culture programme. I mean, there was a big burst. You had Network 7, which again was the brainchild of Charlie Parsons. So there was just an explosion of youth culture television, and it was really vibey, and there were some fantastic people who were working in TV at the time. Muriel Gray was one of those people. The Big Breakfast came out of it as well. But The Word was the music programme, and it was the one. It was so anarchic. I remember just not being able to believe what was going on when we were doing the shows, because you had no idea. People were just misbehaving all the time. It was live television. It was super, super exciting. Anything could go wrong, and it did every single week. And people have tried to emulate that ever since, but nothing will ever be like The Word. Can I also say, with The Word, it was also like the unpredictability was what made it so great. The longer it went on for, it became a challenge. So all the bands just wanted to do the most outrageous thing. And as a music researcher, as the booker, I just used to be watching all the bands thinking, oh my God, what are they going to do this time round? So we had Dinosaur Jr., who just carried on playing, and they wouldn't stop playing, and the whole show was coming to an end, and there was this sound engineer who was running around, who was literally physically pulling out all the leads to try and cut their sound because they just wouldn't stop. And the Manic Street Preachers did a different version, or did an entirely different song that was very sweary compared to what they were supposed to do. So every single week I was just like, oh okay, what now?
In 93, Matthew Bannister was unveiled as the new station controller of Radio 1, which sparked a minor revolution. As one of the new recruits drafted in to regain the station's youth demographic, how much pressure were you under to deliver the required image, and how did it feel being part of something which shook up the whole broadcasting landscape?
I'm going to sound really glib here, but Steve Lamacq and I were just... We were just two young, relatively young people who were really into music. And, I don't think we were so aware of what we were brought in to do. We weren't really savvy enough. We were just thrilled to have the opportunity, and we just wanted to play all our favourite bands on the radio. So we were really just quite naive and maybe a bit punk in our attitude. So we weren't massively aware that we were part of a revolution. You know, now in hindsight, I know exactly what was going on, and we'll be eternally grateful to Matthew Bannister for giving us that break. But I'd grown up listening to Radio 1. I loved everything about it. I really did. And it just felt extraordinarily exciting to be tucked away in the evenings. We never wanted to be main stage. We never wanted to be the ones that were spearheading any kind of revolution. We were just really happy to be getting music that we absolutely loved out to a wider audience. And it's only with the benefit of hindsight that you go, oh yeah, well, that was actually quite pivotal and that was very important. We were just super excited to be interviewing Radiohead and Pulp and Blur and all these people who were making incredible music to get them out to a bigger audience.
Throughout history, musicians and artists have taken inspiration to do what they do from the socioeconomics of their childhood. What do you think it was about growing up in the 80s which made musicians from all walks of life and all areas of the country feel so empowered to make music?
I think, God, that's a big question. I think the 80s was, it was a time of money. There was a lot of money going around, and in terms of culture, it was everything was just very, very flash. And I think in the 90s it was kind of a reaction to that, that people wanted to see themselves represented in the media and on the radio and in television. So the likes of people who had working class backgrounds were fed up of not seeing themselves represented on Top of the Pops. And this was all part of the revolution, I suppose, that happened with the Evening Session and with Oasis, and then the eventual route to getting, Noel Gallagher ending up at number 10. there was a lot going on. So there was kids like me growing up in the 80s, not seeing themselves represented anywhere, but wanting their stories told and wanting to be represented. So I guess That's not a brilliant answer, but that's as good as I can give you.
That's fine.
Is that okay?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Can I just add to that? That last question. I think there was kind of a naivety possibly. Yeah. Like I said, me and Steve just wanting to being on the radio and being given an opportunity, and we kind of took it for granted, but there was a big element of naivety, and I think that was going on with all the musicians. So from Damon to Noel to Jarvis to Tom York to anybody that was making music at the time, it felt easy. It felt a natural progression, and not entitlement, but just thinking, well, just wanting to put ourselves out there. And it obviously chimed with other people of our generation, other people who were just like us. And it was fresh and it was exciting because people were really bored of just seeing quite bland music and seeing lots of money being paraded on television in lots of different aspects. There was a hunger and an appetite for something a little bit different, something that represented the real youth culture that was going on. Mm. There you go.
Your first major Radio 1 vehicle was the evening session alongside the great Steve Lamacq. In hindsight, how significant was this show in giving a platform to artists who would go on to define a generation?
It was huge. I mean, the evening session was absolutely huge, just because it was part of the whole 90s scene, the Britpop scene. I think Chris Evans was also part of the equation because Steve and I were there sort of, you know, at the gateway, and we were given exposure to all those different bands that I've just mentioned, whether it was Elastica, Sleeper, Shed 7, Cast, Oasis, Pulp, Blur. There were lots and lots of, there was a lot of talent. So that was another key thing that, and I don't know why, but there were some extraordinarily important and talented people. You know, I think Damon is one of the geniuses of our generation. You've also got the explosion in dance music, so Prodigy, Underworld, Chemical Brothers, all these artists who are still, and Manic Street Preachers, I haven't even mentioned them, all these artists who were very, very gifted. They had a lot to say. They were very passionate and very disgruntled about what was going on in their world, and they were making fantastic music. And it all kind of got funneled through the evening session, and then Chris Evans, who was then appointed the breakfast show, he was given the breakfast show by Matthew Bannister, was able to just make it explode to everybody else because he had a much bigger audience than we did. But we kind of worked together. So Chris is very savvy, and Chris then went on to do TFI Friday, and it was all part of the chain of events, really. But the evening session was extremely important, and I'm very proud to have been part of it. But Steve and I weren't some Machiavellian kind of beaming intelligent people. We were just there loving music and putting it out to a wider audience.
If you had to pick one moment which sums up Britpop, what would it be?
There was a great Glastonbury. I think it was 95, and that was when Pulp were playing and Blur. I remember Damon and Justine were there, and they were this, you know, golden Britpop couple. They were everything you ever aspired to be. They were so ridiculously cool. Pulp replaced Stone Roses, and that was a huge moment. I'm not sure whether that was 94 or 95. I'd have to look that up. But there were a couple of Glastonbury's which were where it just all came together for Britpop, and it was the sweetest time. It was magical. It really was. Robbie left Take That. Everything happened. You know, he was hanging out with Oasis, and it just bonkers. It was absolutely bonkers, but it was a very golden time. Mm.
You mentioned Glastonbury there. In 97, BBC secured the rights to cover the Glastonbury Festival, and you were chosen to preside over the action alongside the legendary John Peel. To what extent do you feel this was the start of the corporation's acknowledgement of live music?
I think BBC had been involved before, and then Channel 4, it kind of flip-flopped. So BBC did it, and then Channel 4 took over, and then BBC properly took it on. I think the Glastonbury, the coverage that we did, it probably did cement in the BBC's mind that there was a massive appetite for live music, and that has just gone from strength to strength. And, you know, the coverage that we do now with Glastonbury, I think, is unbelievable, the fact. And technology has obviously grown with that too, so that you can now access... Yeah. All those different sets, and you can flip-flop between one and the other when you're watching Glastonbury, and then you can watch it for days afterwards. It's been such a huge revolution in live music. Mm.
What are your memories of working alongside the great John Peel?
Oh, so many fantastic ones. My main ones are of him just talking about his family, and he was such a family man. And at the time, I'd just got my daughter, and I was I wasn't sure how cool it was to acknowledge that you had children. It's nothing like it is today. But at the time I was like, oh God, I should just be talking about indie bands and drinking cider. But when I spent time with John and he talked so lovingly about his family, that it really made me realise that family is everything, and it's actually really cool to talk about your family, and it's fine. So I used to hang on his every word, and also the respect that he had for different artists that would come and play for us. I remember Lonnie Donegan came and did a set, and Lonnie Donegan didn't naively mean very much to me at the time, but John couldn't even go and speak to him because he was so much in awe, because Lonnie Donegan was such an important person in the history of music. And I remember looking at John going, wow, that's amazing. And that taught me to have great respect for musicians as well, and humility.
Glastonbury wasn't the only vehicle where you've championed live music, though. Tell us about the beginnings of Radio 1's Live Lounge, and in what ways has it exceeded your expectations?
Oh, God, the Live Lounge has just kind of snowballed into this gargantuan thing. It's part of the establishment now. Honestly, I think it all began when Mark and Lard did a outside broadcast. They were in Robin Hood's Bay, I think I remember, and they had Travis playing, and Travis did a cover, I think, of Hit Me Baby One More Time, Britney Spears. And God's honest truth, I think that was the beginning of the Live Lounge and the whole cover like obsession that we have to this day. And then someone, my producer or somebody, I don't even know who it was, had the idea of doing the Live Lounge. And I was, because I was at Radio 1 and I was doing the mid-morning show, I became the custodian of it. So I'm so proud of what we achieved. And it was just such a really fun thing to do. All the bands coming up with the most unlikely covers, Biffy Clyro doing Rihanna's Umbrella. It was just every time we'd put it out there to people and say, well, what cover are you going to do? And we'd be waiting with bated breath to see what they were going to come up with, because everyone was trying to do something completely unexpected. I remember 30 Seconds to Mars, so Jared Leto doing Kanye West. I think that he did Stronger. So it was just like, oh my God, what's this going to be like? And it went on for so long, it's like 8 minutes long, and it crashed the news. I remember sitting there thinking, oh God, we've got, the news is coming up and they're still playing. So it was an exciting time, and quite often quite terrifying as well.
You just said you'd never think that Mark and Lars would be influential to the Live Lounge.
They were.
In what ways do you think the Lunchtime Social set the benchmark for the interactivity with stars on mainstream daytime radio that you see today?
Hang on one second, my son's just walked into the room. I'm just going to explain. I'm just doing an interview. It's fine to come in and out. That's fine. This is the trouble of doing an interview this early in the morning. The rest of the family just waiting.
Breakfast on.
Can I ask the question again? Let me just get my head around it.
Yeah. In what ways do you think the Lunchtime Social set the benchmark for the interactivity with stars on mainstream daytime radio that you see today?
God, that's a good question. I guess it made things a bit different from just doing straightforward interviews. And I think maybe people who before had been quite niche were then exposed on the Lunchtime Social, and we had lots of really good conversations. So you'd get fans like I just mentioned Biffy Clyro, and you just see another side to them. And I've always really, really loved interviewing people. I like getting great music, new music out to a bigger audience, but I love getting people to chat and to show a different side to them. So that's what I always wanted to do, I think, with the more alternative bands. So I think part of the one of the legacies of the evening session, we used to get co-presenters in to do the show with us. So we had Jarvis Cocker came and Keith Flint from The Prodigy and Carl from Underworld, and they co-presented the show, and you get to see a different side to them. We got them to do stupid things, ridiculous things, and that is probably what's carried on with Greg James, who's on Radio 1 today, the more frivolous stuff that he does. But I think we started off doing that on the evening session. We got Coolio to come in. We had a feature called the 30 minute menu, and we got stars to come up with their favourite recipes. And Coolio did, he did some kind of chicken recipe, but it was just ridiculous to have Coolio talking about cooking on the show. And that, I think, is part of what happens today on radio. So I think it maybe was quite pivotal. And just asking people the more frivolous questions, people who were perceived to being very serious and very earnest, actually showing a more lighthearted side of themselves. That's what I tried to do.
Were you sad when you had to say goodbye to Radio One and the Live Lounge? And what do you think that sort of tenure at Radio One said about the evolution of music?
Was I sad? It was time to leave Radio One, so I actually wasn't that sad. And the opportunity I was given at Radio Two still involved music, because it was Bob Shannon asked me to go and do the In Concert series on Radio Two. So to me, it was a gift. I knew it was time to leave Radio One, but I was still going on to do live music. So it was a win-win situation. It was a really emotional show because we had Jay-Z coming to do the Live Lounge from my house, and that was insane, but really, really fun to do. He was very sweet, by the way. I remember him sitting with my grandma, drinking champagne and eating strawberries, and he was just it was a really lovely memory to have. Ask the question again. The next bit of it.
Looking at your Radio 1 tenure as a whole, what do you think it said about the evolution of music?
Oh my God. I know what it is. It's the people who grew up listening to me on the evening session grew with me. So they aged with me, and they still have that passion for music, which I have today. And I can see that they have on Radio 2 as well. And it was time when I left Radio 1, it was time for me to hand over the baton to someone who was younger and still in the thick of what was important to Radio 1. Radio 1's always been about youth culture and talking to the people who are growing up. So it was right that I graduated onto Radio 2, took all the people with me who were the same kind of age and had the same musical passion and interests, and took those onto Radio 2, which is what I've been able to do today.
What was it like going to Radio 2 versus being at Radio 1 with very prescriptive playlists and being able to now celebrate a slightly broader music base?
At Radio 2?
Yeah.
It was, I'm so grateful that I am given the freedom that I have at Radio 2. It was to be able to invent a show, which is kind of what I've done with the evening show. I mean, it was, you know, I feel like I've gone back to the evening session, to be honest with you. It feels like I've gone full circle, and I couldn't be happier to be able to create a show for an audience that I have today. Feels quite specific. And it's when I was on the evening session, when I was on the evening session, I always had really broad taste. I used to say it was a broad church. And then again, the lunchtime social that I did at Radio 1, it was, you know, I love dance music. I love hip hop. I like acoustic stuff. I like pop music. And that's what I did at Radio 1. And that's what I do now on Radio 2. So it was very freeing. And I would always be grateful to Bob Shannon for just giving me that blank canvas, really, to create a new show.
Looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
My proudest achievement is it's just the bands, I think, that we've spotted from an early stage and been able to get them to play them to a wider, to lots and lots of people, and for them then to go on and have great careers. So the likes of Coldplay, I think Steve Lamacq actually did the very first session. I did the next session with them. And then to support them throughout their entire career and to see them now go on to be this global phenomenon that they are today, that's to have just been a little a link in the chain of their success is something I'm really, really proud of. And I'll always want to carry on doing that. I'll always want to play bands who are at the very beginning of their career and support them. To carry on supporting them is absolutely crucial, because it's fine to play a band once or twice. But those bands need your support all the way along, or else they're not going to succeed. And, you know, the music industry will not support them. So it's important that we still do that. So, yeah, it's that, really.
Right. What does radio mean to you?
Radio is everything. I think it's the most important medium. And that's been shown again and again and again throughout the past few years with the pandemic, when people were trapped in their homes and not able to go out. And there were a lot of very, very lonely people. They all turned to radio because they wanted a friendly voice and they wanted live, you know, someone to speak to them live and direct, which you can't get always on television. So it's just, it's that intimacy, that just that having one person that you feel is a friend that you can rely on and will you know, reflect your moods and the way you're feeling at the time. So we're there to comfort people. We're also there to lift them and make them laugh, which I think Greg does really well on Radio One. And yeah, you just have to, I think radio is the most important medium there is.
Mm. Lastly, what's next for Joe Wiley?
I'm just going to keep on keeping on. That's all I want to do. I just love my show. I don't want to leave it. I've had such a great couple of weeks I did a session with Marcus Mumford that went out last night, and that was just great because he was talking about his new album where he addresses the sex abuse that he had as a kid, that he's endured and he survived. And he did a very, very honest and brave interview with me. But then he also played amazing music and the session was fantastic. And if I carry on doing that kind of thing, which I used to do on the evening session, if I can carry on doing that in 10 years' time, I will be ridiculously happy. We had Hot Chip, done an interview with Björk. The fact that I'm still doing those kind of interviews and still having shows like After the Queen's Death, where we had such a warm response to people saying how comforting it was and how they relied on listening to the show to get them through very dark times. And that will do me fine. If I can carry on doing that, then that's my life made.
Excellent. Perfect way to end. Lovely.
Gosh, it's so good. Thank you. Your questions were the deepest and most challenging questions I've had in a long time. So thank you.
Thanks very much.